You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And as Bandmeister Ludwig von Beethoven indicates, you are here for another hour of scintillating conversation about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. Today is Thursday, and this being Thursday, we are here with my good friend, Mr. Douglas Aloysius. I'm just guessing that there's an Aloysius in there somewhere. O'Brien.
Aloysius Francis O'Brien.
It should be Aloysius Francis. Is there an Aloysius in there, or is it just Francis?
It's Aloysius Francis.
Are you kidding me? There really is an Aloysius in there?
No, I am absolutely kidding you.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's, what a letdown. Anyway, we're here today with Doug O'Brien. He's my good friend. He lives out there in Chicago. Out there currently enduring, I'm sure, Arctic temperatures and all kinds of winter horrors because it's Chicago and it's winter still. But
actually, Mark, and I actually have to mention this, we have had a week of 60 and 70 degree temperatures.
Get out, really? 70 degree temperatures?
Yeah, in the middle of February. Yes.
That's pretty weird.
It's shocking. So,
All that global warming stuff, I think.
I was going to say, it's making me start. I think a lot of Chicago is starting to rethink this whole concern of global warming.
Yeah. I just let the scientists do their thing.
We may become the Miami of the North, you know.
Yeah, something to shoot for. And Miami could become the hell of the South. I was in Miami once. I invited out for this thing. For the year of Jubilee in April of 2000, they asked me down to this thing. And so I went down to this thing, this big thing that the Archdiocese of Miami was putting on. And it was like, I got down there and I showed up and I was supposed to go and speak at their conference. Well, it turned out whoever was organizing it was a Catholic. And which is always a bad sign when it comes to organized. People ask me if I believe in organized religion. I always say, no, I'm a Catholic. And this whole thing was organized by Catholics. And so consequently, after they asked me down and I had paid my way to come down to this conference, they did not actually mention in any of their materials anywhere that I was there. So I was supposed to like give a talk, you know, and like nobody came because nobody knew that I was there. And there was just like no mention in any of the promotional materials, any of the, the program materials or anything. So I wound up talking to a room full of about six people, and who had somehow figured out that I was going to be there. But my main memory of Miami in April was, boy howdy, it's hot in Miami even in April. I'm from Washington. I'm a Northwest boy, so I'm used to 50 degrees in April, and sometimes we even get snow. But jeepers, it was like 90 degrees. You go out there and sit on the beach because it's Miami, so you're like 50 feet away from the beach all the time wherever you are. And that was my main memory of Miami, was it was incredibly hot in April.
Well, I've got to say, many days I wish I had that problem of being too hot and being 50 feet from the beach. So I think many Chicagoans share that sentiment.
You are 50 feet from the beach. Well, I mean, it's just the beach of Lake Michigan.
It is beautiful, right.
That's right, and Lake Michigan is a beautiful lake when it's not sinking the Edmund Fitzgerald,
That's right. Yeah, no, so. Actually it is. And when we moved away for a period, is that I will tell you, I could not imagine how much I miss the lake. It's a great and beautiful natural wonder.
It's true. Where,
you, you,
Where'd you move away to?
Well, first to D.C., and then secondly to Vermont. So,
okay.
In both cases, they have wonderful things and wonderful scenery and exciting things, but my family and myself are outdoorsy, and so we like to sail and fish and kayak in Lake Michigan, and you know, just spend time at the beach, and it really is a phenomenal natural wonder. And I've often thought what the first French, you know, priest explorers thought when they came to the Great Lakes, because they you know, essentially inland oceans of fresh water, which must have seemed to them like paradise. So
I think I read somewhere that the Great Lakes constitute 1/5 of the entire globe's freshwater supply.
That's correct.
Yeah, it's just a lot of fresh water out there is what that is. And all runoff from this, everything that doesn't go to the Mississippi River winds up in Lake Michigan and all the rest of it. Yeah. Yeah. I used to live in Detroit. And so Detroit has like sort of mini little adjuncts to the Great Lakes.
That's right.
So there's like Lake St. Clair, which is this itsy bitsy. It's still a colossal lake.
Right.
But it's nothing.
It's between Erie and Huron. Lake Huron, Erie, right.
Yeah. And that thing used to, I remember going out on it when I was a boy. And that thing would freeze solid. There would be cars out on Lake St. Clair.
Right.
And you go out there and you'd cut a hole in the ice and you'd fish for fish. And then you'd lay the fish on the ice after you caught them. And then you'd bring them home and cook them. And they tasted like gasoline because of all the cars that were driving around on the lake. And then you would learn your lesson about not putting fish on the ice. But this is back in the days, which we will soon be returning to, thank God. The Lake St. Clair at that time, 1965, was a lake that, like Lake Erie and things like the Monongahela River, could taste like gasoline and could, in the case of the Monongahela River, actually catch fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we were not cursed with the Environmental Protection Agency. And we will soon be getting rid of that again. that pesky Environmental Protection Agency that stopped the natural course of events when rivers catch fire and massive pollution is everywhere. So I'm sort of curious. I mean, you've still got friends in D.C. Do you get like, I'm sorry?
I said, yes, correct.
Do you get like desperate phone calls in the middle of the night saying, please come and help us. Please save us. We can't stop them. They're everywhere and they're destroying it all.
This is literally a true story.
Okay.
So the short answer is yes, but to give you a sense, my wife and I, on Tuesday when you were so romantically falling ill with the flu, I'm sure your wife loved that.
She did.
My wife and I knew that our kids' schedule made it difficult for us to have a romantic dinner, so we went out the night prior, Monday night, and so we were actually having our romantic Valentine dinner when my phone rang, and it was actually a lobbyist friend. And when I say lobbyist, I don't mean a lobbyist like for big oil. This person is a lobbyist for hungry people and the protection of the social safety net. And she was calling me. I think she'd actually had a few too many.
Okay.
And she was calling me.
Probably a lot of that.
Yeah, to despair. Her meetings of the day, right? So, yeah, I hear, I would say, at least a couple times a week, unsolicited from advocates and Democratic staff about the challenges. I think in many cases, though, to be candid, people call me to try to get a better read of what's going on in the hinterland. You know, especially with the town hall meetings.
And by hinterland, you mean the third most populous city?
Yeah, I know. And to be honest, though, my party has not always been strong that way. I mean, yes, Chicago is a Democratic city, but remember, is that I live in the outside of the city, so I'm in a more rural area. But the long and short is that people are wondering, you know, is the town hall stuff Is it as vociferous? Is it seem as organic? And, you know, obviously I'm not attending these town halls, so I know the same thing that the media is reporting. But, you know, there seems to be some buyer's remorse, I think, from some folks. But, yeah, people in D.C. are a little challenged. Haven't talked to many Republican friends except what they've posted socially, and I get a sense that some, depending on where they stand on the spectrum, are kind of saying, you know, this is to be expected, and others are kind of taking the McCain position, which is we're disappointed, wish he hadn't said that, especially related to the courts or mm-hmm. or as it relates to the problem with the travel ban. Mm-hmm.
Or declaring the media the enemy of the American people.
Yeah, that was, wow. You know, I was doing some work. I'm right now serving as a peer reviewer for two academic journal articles, and that is, you know, kind of tedious, right? And so I have the background, the press conference, and holy cow.
Yeah. it was surreal. I mean, it was, and I mean, really, it's a line, literally a line right out of Stalin, Mao, Hitler. All of these guys use that kind of language to try to shut down all other venues of information and make the dear leader the sole source of truth. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Doug O'Brien, and we'll be back right after this on Redbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
The Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Mr. Doug O'Brien, and I am trying to avoid coughing into the microphone, which I'm failing at, and am about to do again. It's this stupid cold. I just can't shake it. But I read an interesting piece today. It came out of the South Bend Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine sent it to me by some guy named Evan Smith. And it's an editorial. And it says, Democrats should look to Pope Francis. Now, I remember a time long ago as one of those Catholics who thought what our country needs to do is listen to the gospel more. That was one of those things that I was taught to say by the religious right, in fact, in the 1990s. It's very important that we look to the gospel and turn away from secular humanism and et cetera. And the problem with you Democrats was you just don't care about the gospel. All you care about is your secular humanism. That's what you care about. And this is what I was taught 20 years ago. Well, there was an interesting speech that was given by Russell Moore. He's a Southern Baptist. And he was given an award by whoever it is that runs First Things. And he gave a speech. This is just a couple of months back. And the title of the speech was, Can the Religious Right Survive? My People, My Tribe. And in the course of the speech, he makes a couple of interesting points. But one of the crucial things that he says is that he summed it up by saying the religious right are now the people the religious right warned you about 20 years ago. And one of the really key points that he made was the religious right no longer measures its thinking or actions according to the gospel. It measures its thinking and actions according to and against its culture war enemies. So whatever they're doing, if they're in favor of it, we're against it. And if they touch it, they render it ritually impure by their presence. So this editorial comes out today basically saying, hey, Democrats, we should be listening to Pope Francis because he's got a lot of really good things to say. And I've seen this happen before. It happened a couple of years ago, for example, when Elton John, of all people, gave some interview in which he said he really respected Pope Francis. And the response from the religious right, my tribe, my people, was not, hey, Elton John, who 10 years ago was calling for the worldwide destruction of the Catholic Church, is now listening to the Vicar of Christ, the heir of Peter, the Holy Father, Pope Francis. That seems like a step forward. And it was not that that was not the response at all. The response was, this just goes to show you what a worthless liberal Pope Francis is. And it was like, what the hell, you know? But when an editorial like this comes out saying, hey, Democrats, we should be listening to Pope Francis. He's got a lot of really good things to say that comport very well with what we believe as Democrats. I know that the response will be, will basically bear out what Russell Moore said in his talk again, that the religious right are now the people that the religious right warned you about 20 years ago, because the response will not be, hey, look, this Democrat is urging other Democrats to listen to the Vicar of Christ, the Magisterium, and the Chief Shepherd and Teacher of Holy Church. Isn't that a good thing that Democrats are listening to the Catholic Church? That won't be the response at all. The response will be, this just proves what a catastrophe Pope Francis is. And I find that mind-boggling as a Catholic and as somebody who for 30 years has been saying, hey, we should be listening to the Catholic Church because, you know, the Catholic Church is, you know, that vessel in which subsists the gospel of Jesus Christ and the sacramental presence of Christ on earth, and et cetera, et cetera. And it's that for me is the great tragedy of my time, that the people who I spent my whole adult life believing when they said, we're not the cafeteria Catholics. We listen to what the church has to say, and we don't edit it and we don't throw it away, you know, if it doesn't suit us. These are the guys now who are spending more time at war with Pope Francis than any other subculture in the church.
Well, you know, what I think that does, though, is it also exposes, you know, we talked a little bit about this a couple weeks ago, is that it kind of exposes this kind of idolatry, right? That is somewhat manifest in our current political discourse. And, you know, I've told you before, and I remain a Democrat, some oftentimes uneasily so, right? But, you know, for me, it's because I do look at my faith seriously. And apart from, and it's a serious apart, I'm not in any way trying to minimize this, but apart from the position on abortion that the Democrats have publicly stated, and I find to be horrendous and evil, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, of course.
So many other things, though, are consistent with this ethic that I have been catechized to both believe and project, right? Which is protection of the earth, protection value of one's labor, the care of the sick and the vulnerable and the immigrant, right? So I get that. And I think what's troubling to me is that especially this last election cycle has kind of smoked out this idolatry that exists, you know, in among many American Christians, not just Catholics. You know, you mentioned the gentleman from the Southern Baptist. I believe he leads their committee on religious liberty and ethics or something in D.C. And, you know, and that's causing its own cannibalism within the Southern Baptists, right? And, you know, you have Southern Baptist churches which are refusing now to pay their annual dues because they're unhappy by this moderation and lack of support for the Trump agenda. And you've got, you know, really devout Catholics who seem to be turning, or at least criticizing the Pope publicly, right? Because the Pope's policies differ from that of the current U.S. president. And that's very troubling, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it kind of turns on its head, this idea of us Christians being in the world, but not of the world. Right. And we're seeing it play out, you know, sadly, almost every day.
Yeah.
In the news.
Yeah. And what always appalls me, you know, and I keep returning to this because it keeps happening every single day, is we're told the rhetoric is always abortion. That's the core thing. That's what we need to be all about and all focused on. And my response is, would to God that were true. From the religious right. Would to God that the religious right actually simply focused on the defense of the unborn. But they don't. What they're spending their time doing is fanning out every single day to repeat whatever lie, and that's the exact word for it, whatever lie the Trump administration is feeding out into the bloodstream of the body politic today. So this week, the catchphrase is fake news.
Right.
And what right-wing Catholics and evangelicals are spending all their time doing is they're not talking about the unborn. They're repeating this stuff about fake news. And could there be anything more ridiculous than a man who says that Ted Cruz's dad helped kill JFK? And, Obama is a Kenyan and was not born in the United States. And he had the biggest electoral vote since Reagan, and his inaugural, crowd was bigger than forget what you could actually see with your own two eyes. And believe me, that guy is preaching to us about fake news. Seriously?
Right.
You know, but that's what evangelicals and what conservative Catholics are spending their time and energy on. They're not spending it on the unborn.
No, and in fact, recently one of the Catholic political groups, I don't know if it's Catholic Vote or who it was, but actually went after a bishop in San Diego for his resistance to Trump's immigration policies.
Right.
And what I was struck by when I saw the email was just how un-Catholic that actually was.
Right. And how completely unmoored it is from the supposed core issue of abortion. Nothing to do with it. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Doug O'Brien. We'll be back on Redbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Redbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at redboxmedia.com. Redbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Shots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Doug O'Brien. And we're just talking about, you know, the Catholic approach to, in this case, to ordering the common good. That's what our politics is about. That's why government exists. The purpose of the government is to help preserve and protect the common good. That's what it's for. And everything that we do that has to do with politics in the state, you know, we have a privilege that our ancestors didn't have for most of human history, which is we get to have a say in how we order the common good. For the bulk of human history, people lived under some form of monarchy or autocratic state or other. And if you were a peasant, you just kept your head down and did what you were supposed to do. And if things got really terrible, you might participate in some uprising, which would then be crushed and you would be killed.
Right.
You know, you wind up with, along with Spartacus and 6,000 other guys crucified along the roads to Rome, because that's what happened to poor people who said, my life sucks, and I'm going to try to do something about it. But we actually live in a time and a place, which is a relative rarity in human history, where we get to participate in how to order the common good. And that is, that has always been the preference of the Catholic Communion. So the Catholic Communion, for example, it immediately begins with people who ordered their own internal affairs in a conciliar way. So when the church had to figure out what to do about Gentiles wanting to become Christian, they didn't just wait for Peter the Pope to hand down an edict. Instead, they met in a council, the Council of Jerusalem. You can read about it in Acts chapter 15. And Thomas Aquinas will later on also prefer some kind of consensus approach to governance. He's a Dominican. And the Dominicans have the distinction of being, now, today, the oldest democratic institution on planet Earth. When Dominicans want to figure out what they're going to do, their instinct has always been from the beginning to do it in a conciliar way. And so the Dominicans meet every few years, and they have a consensus approach to how they do things. So... that kind of thinking is what gave birth to, for example, the British parliamentary system, which is a product of medieval Catholic culture. And it was British political thought that came out of medieval Catholic culture that gave birth to, among other things, the American constitutional order. And so we are the beneficiaries of a Catholic heritage that we should get down on our knees and thank God for every day. We're living in a spot of bother right now, but we still have a lot going for us as a people with this heritage. There was this article that came out from the South Bend Tribune. This guy Evan Smith is basically saying, "Hey, Democrats, we should be listening to Pope Francis because he's got a lot to say to us." And he outlines three points that I thought were interesting. I just wanted to kind of touch on them briefly. He says, Pope Francis, he talks about Pope Francis emphasizing encounter, mercy, and solidarity, all of which is true. So in his letter, The Joy of the Gospel, Evangelii Gaudium, he's urging us, among other things, to encounter the first thing that the gospel has to do. The first thing we have to do to order the common good is we have to, as Smith says, go out from our comfort zones and experience the struggles of other people's lives, talk with and listen to people. Francis, he says, applies this to struggling families, unemployed young people, abandoned elderly people, workers whose jobs have gone away, victims of violence and abuse, immigrants and refugees. We could apply it to people with different political views, too. That's, you know, that's the first thing that really struck me about this article is this is a Democrat who's essentially saying, look, we should listen to people on the other side of the aisle.
Right.
That's not a sentiment I'm hearing from my own tribe. Republicans, the response is Democrats are the enemy and exist to be destroyed. We must defeat them. And that's the only thing that we have to say to them is, you know, perish heretic. It's remarkably generous of him to take that approach to people who refer. I hate this term because I have friends, for example, who have children with Down syndrome, various mentally challenged people. One of the most vile terms that I hear constantly applied by Christians, among others, to their political enemies is libtard. I hate that word with the white hot passion of a thousand suns. Because it insults friends of mine who, you know, have Down syndrome and all the rest of it. And I really hate that. But, you know, this guy's response is Francis calls us to encounter. And that means encountering people with really different views from mine. In this case, he's talking about conservatives. Me. Because I've always thought of myself as a conservative because if you belong to a tradition, well, what do traditions do? They conserve stuff. And so I respect that. I had a really cool thing happen a couple of days ago. I just put up a note. I'm one of these weird people that likes Lent.
I do too.
Yeah. I love it. And I put up a note.
To refocus, you know.
Yeah,
absolutely. I'm with you.
Next week, I want to take the whole time next Thursday and just talk about how did your Ash Wednesday go? And what are you doing for Lent? I don't want to do it this week because it's too early. But I put this note up just saying, I like Lent.
Yeah, me too.
And this lady writes in, very sweet lady. She turns out to be 66 years old. She's got a granddaughter, has, you know, adorable pictures of her granddaughter. And she said, you know, I don't know anything about Lent. And I'm not baptized. I'm working on that. What's Lent? And it was we wound up having the sweetest conversation. And it was just, she just wanted to know. Didn't know anything about it. Didn't know anything about the gospel. Her dad used to read the Bible. And that's what she remembered was her dad talked about the Bible. She had never been to church. Didn't know anything about Christians or the weird things that we do. And she just wanted to know. So what's, you know, I told her it was about prayer, fasting, and almsgiving. What's amesgiving? She wrote back because she read it wrong. And then she said the sweetest thing. It brought tears to my eyes. It still brings tears to my eyes. I talked about how Lent was recalling Jesus's time in the desert,
right,
and his time of fasting. And she said, so are we supposed to pray for Jesus because he's suffering? And I thought, oh, you sweet thing. You know, that would be her first thought was that poor Jesus is suffering, and so we should pray for him. And I just thought, wow. Yeah. I have been given a real privilege just having a chance to talk to this lady. And that's encounter. You know, that's what Francis is calling us to do, is just get out there and talk to people who are really different from us. In this case, this lady who doesn't know the first thing about Lent, but just wanted to know and was asking all these good, honest, sweethearted questions. And when she was, when we were done talking, she was like, well, I'm really looking forward to Lent now. It was just so darling, you know. Do you, I mean, Chicago is like heavy Catholic town.
Yes.
Do you have opportunities where you just run into people who are just like from completely outside the Catholic world who are wanting to know what's going on.
You know, I encountered that more in D.C., to be honest, than I do here. I mean, Chicago really is a very Catholic city.
Okay.
You know, for example, if anyone listening were to go on Ash Wednesday and drive downtown in the Loop, there's a famous old church called St. Peter's, just a block from City Hall. And on Ash Wednesday, the line to receive ashes throughout the day literally wraps around a full city block. And it's all day, right? And you get people who maybe in the course of their daily activities or work really don't identify with their Catholicism. But on this day, you just can't miss it walking down the street. So I think in a city like Chicago, you see it much more. But, you know, we've all encountered people who don't really understand our faith or what Lent's about or have whose knowledge of Christmas is limited to Santa Claus and, you know, and sales, right?
Yeah.
I think it's beautiful what you described. And that's why I also look forward to Lent.
Cool. We will be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Doug O'Brien. And we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
To Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Doug O'Brien talking about this article by Evan Smith in the South Bend Tribune that's basically talking to Democrats. He's a Democrat. He's talking to other Democrats and saying we could actually learn a lot from Pope Francis, so we should listen to him. And he makes the point that there are three points that Francis has emphasized: encounter, mercy, and solidarity. We talked a little bit in the last segment about encounter. He also goes on, he talks about mercy. He says, our country needs this so badly. Our default first reaction to someone who is different from us cannot be outrage. Yet we see that all the time in our politics, in our Facebook feeds, in shootings at churches and mosques. Pope Francis has shown how mercy, unexpected kindness and care, especially when it's not deserved, allows people to find surprising new ways to live together peacefully. Shakespeare famously says, you know, where to serves mercy but to confront the visage of offense. And the point of mercy is precisely that it's not deserved. Strictly speaking, a person can't deserve mercy, because the whole point of mercy is that it is grace and love shown to the undeserving. So
like Paul poor sinners like you and I, right?
Yes, exactly right. So Paul tells us that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. It was, you know, when the whole point of the gospel is that God handed himself over to us and said, you can do with me whatever you want. And we gave it a lot of thought, and we decided the best thing that we could do was press down a crown of thorns on his head and beat the living daylights out of him and then drive nails through his hands and feet and watch him gasp out his last breath while we laughed at him. That was what we thought was a good idea. And it's for that species, and by that death, that Christ redeemed us. And so when we start talking about murder, we're talking about the deserving poor, you know?
Right, right.
And this kind of stuff is just like, do you not fear God? when we speak that way. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about mercy. And so the church has always commended to us the corporal and spiritual works of mercy. And we are to give, we can't pay Jesus back for what he's done for us. So he says, pay it forward. Give what you would do to me to the least of these. And that's what we're called to, are these acts of mercy toward people who can't pay us back. I've thought about in the past, and I may yet do it, about writing a piece on Jesus Christ finance advisor and investment counselor, you know, because all the stuff that you hear from investment counselors is always like, you know, be sure and invest in something that will guarantee a return. And what does Jesus tell us to do? Well, you know, when you have a banquet, be sure to invite people who cannot possibly pay you back.
Right. Right.
And that's like really an important stipulation for Jesus. You know, if you give to people who are going to give back to you, well, tax collectors and finance investment counselors do that. You know, right. Any idiot could do that. But instead, give to people who can't repay you. And that's very important. And that's what he did. He gave his life for people who can't possibly repay him for the things that he's done for us. For our sake, you know, he who was rich became poor. So that's the first thing. You were saying something over the break I thought was important. But talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think for me, the biggest issue was, or the most recent news issue was this reversal on the transgender bathroom issue, right? And when the Obama administration issued that executive order requiring public schools to have transgender bathrooms, I thought at the time that was an overreach of the federal government and that it was part and parcel. One of the problems of that administration was that they at times tried to force their version of cultural mores on the rest of the nation, and it was not necessarily appropriate. Now today, though, we have that reversed, and my response, and this is both, I think, were really Catholic responses. My response today is, but why? You know, what advantage does society gain from making 16-year-old confused people, you know, outed, if you will, right? And it doesn't affect my family in any negative way, or me personally, or my faith, or anything else. It's just, it shows a lack of mercy. And, you know, and you know, what you were talking about, as you were talking a moment ago, I was thinking of Robert Kennedy's favorite poem, which is from Aeschylus, and it says, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of the world, right? Is it, whether it's tax policy or the criminal code or bankruptcy law or whatever it is, some of the genius of this nation has been to actually incorporate the gospels, if even indirectly, into our public policies, right? Is it people who can be enormous debtors can file for bankruptcy and over a period of time can restart their lives, which is in some ways like being born again, right? People who violate the law, is it, as long as they're not a threat to the rest of society immediately, can over some period of time do that, you know, do their time and then be released back into society. And there is a merciful aspect that we can project into policy. But I think what's troubling now, and I think and is lost, is how we interact with one another and look at people who offend us or disagree with us or are the other, whether it be the immigrant or another color or a different gender outlook.
Right.
Is it, we do seem to be lacking mercy. And I think, and by the way, that mercy is not just extended to the vulnerable populations of identity politics that my party has been thriving on of late, but it also extends to, guess what? Blue collar white voters in rural America who are clearly anxious and concerned, and which is why they elect this man to be president.
Right.
Is it, it is a merciful, it is looking to other people and seeing Christ in them, even when that's not terribly apparent.
There's a an article actually in the Chicago Tribune. I'm not sure if it came out today or not, but it was basically saying that if we institute the policies designed to punish illegal immigrant workers, especially in the southern part of the United States, it could cost us $5 trillion.
Right.
In lost revenue. Because, of course, you got 20 million people who are doing this work. They are right. thoroughly integrated into the economy. And so I remarked on this and said, you know, this is classic penny-wise, pound-foolish thinking. And the only response that one guy had was, well, they're illegals. And I'm like, so what? I mean, is bureaucratic paperwork so important to you that you're willing to damage the economy to the tune of $5 trillion and uproot the lives of 20 million people who, let's face it, I mean, why are they here? Because they want to have a better life. They're hardworking people. They are disproportionately family-oriented, religious, devout, a huge number of them are Catholic. Why is this Javert-like fascination with crossing T's and dotting I's on immigration paperwork so much more important than that? In the Christian tradition, the law is made for man, not man for the law.
Right.
And so it's just, it is, it's penny-wise, pound foolish. It's billions, trillions of pounds foolish to make that like the most important thing for you. I don't care if it costs $5 trillion. You know?
And remember how when Jesus said that because he and his disciples got food from the temple when they weren't supposed to. Isn't that correct?
Close. They were picking grain on the Sabbath.
And is it for me? It's a bunch of corollaries you're saying. Is it because someone comes to the United States illegally because it's not easy to get into the United States, right? And then takes a job to harvest crops that make food affordable for me and my family and for people who have even less income, right? What do we gain by punishing them, making them always anxious and in fear of the law? I mean, what is the game?
Dotted I's and crossed T's.
Yeah. That's the only one.
That's it. Yeah.
It's pharisaical in its worst possible way.
Right. And it completely lacks the gospel sense of mercy and proportion. Use each man according to his desert and who shall escape whipping, says Hamlet. And that's what this is about. It's like, you know, but they're illegals. And my response is, yes.
Yeah.
So what? Big deal. It matters not at this point. Okay. Well, we are unfortunately out of time, but I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Doug O'Brien, Douglas Aloysius Francis O'Brien. Our producer today was Danny Head, and you have been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'll be back tomorrow with Stephen Gradonis. Till then, have a grand evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.